The opinions expressed on Inside the Black Box do not reflect those of WREK Radio or the Georgia Institute of Technology. Welcome to Inside the Black Box, and the fact that you didn't listen to our theme music today means Trent's caught in traffic, being held up by South of the Border bandits. I don't really know what's going on. Hopefully he's going to be here soon. Filling in ably is Mitch. Mitch, you thought you'd be off doing something instructive at this point, didn't you?
Yeah, no problem, though.
But now you're stuck here. But the title of today's program is More Than Just a Cool Russian Acronym. And, of course, I'm talking about TRIZ. And our guest today is Jack Hipple. And before we get to Jack's bona fides, Jack, you pronounce it sort of, it's TRIZ, which is the sort of Western acronym for this long, drawn-out Russian phrase. And all my colleagues at the National Science Foundation say TRIZ, but you were telling me before it's TRIZ?
Well, if you're around some Russians, you ought to say TRIZ, like a rolling R and a I like two E's.
Right, so basically it's TRIZ, but it's as though Boris would say it on Rocky and Bullwinkle. Natasha, now is our chance to get moose and squirrel with TRIZ.
That's right. It's a Russian acronym for Theory of Solving Inventive Problems.
Okay. And can you actually pronounce the long, drawn-out Russian phrase?
If you want me to, it's the only Russian that I know.
I would love to hear that. Okay, can we hear
that? Theoria, Reshineva, Isorbetadiskelia, Zadash.
Oh, sweet. Just to get that recorded is a good thing. Because I write it in proposals all the time, and I write out this long Cyrillic alphabet thing, and I have no idea how to pronounce that sort of thing. So it's good to finally meet someone that can actually do that. So our guest today, Jack Hipple, is the principal of Innovation TRIZ. And now, is that the old name of the company? You've actually changed
that's it. That's the old name. We're calling ourselves TRIZ and Engineering Training Services today.
Right. And you changed that in 1999. He received his chemical engineering degree from Carnegie Mellon University and spent 30 years in industry focusing on breakthrough research and engineering, including being Dow Chemical's Discovery Research Director and Director of Chemical Engineering and R&D. And you would call yourself an expert in this TRIZ. Is that a correct statement?
Well, I try to be.
Well, you've taught it all over the place, and that's a lot of what your company does, right?
Yeah, it's about half of what we do.
Okay.
And I do all the TRIZ training for the American Institute of Chemical Engineers and the American Society for Mechanical Engineers.
And that's where we met, actually. I think it was a few years back at a Salt Lake City meeting. You were giving a lecture on TRIZ, and I was at least claiming that the use of humorous improvisation that we use to spur creativity can actually work well with all sorts of approaches to problem solving and innovation and design, and TRIZ is one of the ones I mentioned. Of course, I mentioned that because folks like George Hazelrig at the National Science Foundation actually think TRIZ is a very good and useful method. And I guess before we get into sort of the details of what it is and how it works and where it comes from, a lot of my colleagues here at Georgia Tech, we get into this argument that some people say that you cannot teach innovation, you cannot teach creativity. There is no systematic way to innovatively solve problems, that it's just something you have or you get or you get along the way. I mean, do you agree with that statement, or you think that there is a systematic approach to solve problems?
I violently disagree with that statement. I used to believe that myself 20 years ago, but TRIZ is a methodical algorithm that can be used to solve any problem. Certainly there are people that are we would consider more creative than others, but I would have a strong disagreement with that statement that you can't teach innovation and creativity, because that's what TRIZ is all about.
So that's what we want to hear. I want to hear violent disagreement. So that's excellent. That's a good way to start the show. And before we get to that, let's begin the program, as we often do, with
Science in the News.
And today's Science in the News comes from the Science Insider, written by Jeffrey Mervis on May 6th, entitled Eugenie Scott to Retire from U.S. Center That Fights Anti-Evolution Forces. And, you know, this is sort of a biographical thing. A lot of times we put hardcore science on our Science in the News. But I think it's relevant because of one of the claims she makes. So after 26 years, Eugenie Scott had helped teachers do what's right for their students in the name of science. And while the need to defend the teaching of evolution and climate change certainly hasn't disappeared, she announced today that she's stepping down later this year from as the founding CEO and the public face of the National Center for Science Education. And the article talks a lot about how over the years they've worked on this sort of thing. But what strikes me as very interesting is toward the end of the article, she points out that we learned from day one that you don't blunt those attacks by simply shoveling science into the debate. She says you need to recognize the political and economic and cultural issues in play. In the end, it comes down to your powers of persuasion. And this is really something that we've talked about on this program many times before, that simply throwing the math or the science at someone and say, well, there it is, you ought to understand it now, is never a way to get people to understand the value of science, important things in science, whether it's something controversial like evolution and climate change or just regular science and applied science. And we had Randy Olson on the program last year, who, of course, turned from biologist to filmmaker, that would claim that you have to engage people at sort of a gut and heart level, not just their mind. Henry Reich, who was on here explaining his sort of cartoon approach to this, Minute Physics, was on earlier in the year. And actually, I was just up in Washington, D.C., and I want to make a shout-out to Dr. W.T. Bridgman from the Skeptics, the Washington Area Skeptics, who did a review of my show up there. He runs the Crank Astronomy website, and he said, well, Pete's really just saying the things that Randy Olson has said for a long time. I take that as a big compliment, Dr. Bridgman, and I appreciate that shout-out. But this is a point that I just wanted to bring up from Science in the News, that you can't just throw science at people and say, oh, yes, we should have solar energy, or yes, we should do this. You really need to engage them. Now, with that said, let's turn back to the topic at hand, namely trees, which is a systematic way. Is it fair to say a systematic way to solve problems and innovate?
Yes.
Okay. Uh-huh.
It's a good way of describing it.
So what is it?
Trees is basically a very left-brain process, and what it is, the best thing to do is to go back and describe where it came from. Heinrich Altschuler was a really brilliant young naval engineer for the Russian Navy back in the mid to late 40s, and he had 9 patents by the time he was 21 years old on some very unique naval breathing equipment, and the Russian government hired him to be a patent examiner. Most people in the West don't realize that even under communism, the Russians had a patent system, and it functioned just like ours does, with 2 big social exceptions. One, everything was secret, and the government owned all the patents.
Now, that's good for the government.
Yeah, those are 2 big deals, but the process of you as an inventor filing a disclosure and the patent examiner saying, well, that's not a patent, and that dialogue that goes on in our patent system went on in Russia exactly the same way as it does here. And this gentleman, for reasons I don't know that anybody would really ever understand, got fascinated by the fact that he would see patent disclosures coming across his desk from mining and chemicals and machinery, from all kinds of different areas, and looked at these patents and basically said, you know, if you abstract them up a couple of levels, the way somebody is solving a problem in industry A is really the same way they're solving it in industry B. And so he began to collate how people were inventing. And the way he found to describe a truly unique breakthrough patent was where someone resolved, I guess what I would call an Excedrin headache contradiction. And so he culled those patents out of the mass, and it was only, you know, 3 to 5% of the total patent literature. And they said, what was the inventive principle that was used to solve that problem? And after looking at hundreds of thousands of patents, he could only find 40 inventive principles that people kept reusing over and over and over again. And that research that he started has continued to the 8 million patents we have today. And no one can find more than 40 inventive principles. That is something that is really hard to believe, but you know, that's the truth. The other thing that came from continuing to study the patents was you could identify patterns in which products and systems evolved, and also that there was a general problem-solving algorithm that you could use to solve any problem. And that's where this discussion about you can't teach creativity comes in, because there actually is a tree's inventive problem-solving algorithm that can be used to apply to any problem, and anybody can use it.
Well, the first thing you mentioned is this sort of a left-brain process, right? That should scare me right off the bat. And is that why folks like some of my colleagues and you, and I was of this mind as well a while ago, believe that, well, you could never sort of do this sort of thing because we think that we're all sort of, you know, to apply something that is left brain to something that seems so right brain, right? I mean, is that the confusion that people have, that they never thought that would happen?
Well, possibly. If you really truly believe your problem is special and unique, then what I just said to you won't compute at all. And there's an ego factor involved.
Right.
People can't admit that they don't have a special problem. I've talked over the years to a number of creativity associations that use right brain techniques, whether they be De Bono or brainstorming or CPS.
Right.
And there just is a huge gap in understanding. And I've been unable to convince people who have that as a religion. And I'm not sure the gulf will ever get solved, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody, there's an ego thing, as I said, that people like to think their problem is special and unique. And they use all kinds of special words and jargon to reinforce that feeling. And I'll give you a very specific example that I think you can relate to. I was traveling through Houston to the Mexican Trees Association meeting a few years back, and I pulled out the airline catalog from Continental Airlines. And on the back cover of the magazine was a symposium announcement. For the first year, it was called the Pumps and Pipes Symposium. And this was the first time in 50 years, 50-plus years, that the heart surgeons and heart vascular research people in Houston and the oil and gas industry sitting right next to each other in the same city had ever talked to each other. And from a chemical engineering standpoint, fluid going through an oil and gas pipeline is no different than oil, than blood going through an artery. And so these two groups have now started talking to each other after 60 years. And the question I ask myself all the time, what would have happened had they started talking to each other 60 years ago?
Right.
I'm sure that each of them thought that the problem they had was special, but it's friction drop, it's pressure drop, it's Reynolds number. It's all the same thing.
So what year was that you noticed that?
Pardon?
What year was that you noticed that these guys were talking to each other?
2 years ago.
So 2 years ago.
This Pumps and Pipes Symposium, I don't know if it's .com or .org.
Yeah.
But this group has now started to meet in Europe as well.
Wow.
Ford Motor Company trying to find ways to improve headrest design and not paying attention to catcher's mitts mechanics that have been around since the 1890s
mm-hmm.
would be another example.
Right. So I find that ironic because we have entire groups of people in mechanical and chemical engineering who study the flow in the heart and the vasculature using exactly the same tools that chemical and mechanical engineers do to analyze that very thing.
That's right.
So that's part of it too, right? It's the first thing is recognizing this contradiction, right? But part of it is recognizing that if once you generalize things, is it easier to see similarities between what seem like disparate fields when they're really not?
Yeah, that's right, and that's what step zero is getting your mind around that your problem isn't special. And the advice I give people is to take the problem that you have and stop using the jargon and acronyms and special language that you use at work and pretend like you're trying to describe your problem to a 10-year-old and use that word in a Google search. And you will be amazed at what you will find of parallel universes of people working on the same problem. The same area.
Well, let me stop you there again. So that almost seems like an insurmountable thing, right? So as was consistent with the talk that I gave when we met at the AICHE, the American Institute of Chemical Engineers meeting, I'm very interested in humor and its impact on creativity and teaching and education and communication. And if you go to the literature and you look up humor, right, the jargon that they use is almost impenetrable. So, for example, we would think of something like, you know, taking a character and putting them in a different place and time, right? So think of a modern person back in British colonialism, and you'd point out how silly it was that they just walked around and stuck flags and things and claimed them for themselves. This is the humor of Eddie Izzard. And then he did the same thing with the Pilgrims Landing and sort of taking over the country. And what did the guy who wrote the article on this, he called it a chronotope. And there's a whole literature on chronotopes and this the textuality of something, and I can barely understand what they're saying. And really all they're saying is if you take someone and put them in a different time and place, there's an incongruity that makes it funny. My favorite example is Bob Newhart when he played, he was on a phone call with Abraham Lincoln as Abraham Lincoln's press secretary or public relations guy. And he said, you know, wait, Abe, keep the 4 score and 7 years ago. It tested well in focus groups. And it was just funny because you didn't expect that. So instead of saying what I just said in, you know, 30 seconds, there was a 9-page paper on this. How do you get people to give up jargon? I mean, engineers, scientists, anthropologists, we love our jargon. Is there a trick to that other than threatening them?
With great difficulty. In the workshops and the training I run, we spend a great deal of time, you know, trying to educate people to do that. And it's very difficult because it's a switch you have to turn on and off because you use that jargon at work every day. And then when you get in this need to find a breakthrough solution and ask yourself who else has a problem like that, you have to totally change the language and say, who else has a problem like that? I remember doing some work for the Bank of Montreal, and the gentleman said, I want you to work on defalcation in the bank. And I was just dumbfounded. I had no idea what that word means. But if you go to a banking convention, they throw that word around like we're throwing around, you know, telephone or radio.
Right.
It's the banking word for fraud.
Oh, okay.
And trying to get people to move from defalcation to fraud is bad enough, but what we really want to say is the substitution of one thing for another. That's extraordinarily difficult. But again, if you did a Google search on those three terms, you would find orders of magnitude difference and find out where else do people substitute one thing for another.
So
it's very difficult.
You'd find more on the simple word, you'd find more on fraud than you would defalcation?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. And so the point is, if you did it on fraud, what you're saying is you might find some interesting guidance from not just banks, but Vegas, the Vegas Strip, whatever it is.
Absolutely. You know, paintings. Absolutely.
Yeah, right. Classroom teachers, this sort of thing. Wow.
Anything. Right. Okay. There's all kinds of places where people try to do fraud. Or, again, more generally, the substitution of one thing for another. Maybe the illegal substitution.
Right,
And it goes on in a lot of places.
Right. So if you're willing to use the term switcheroo, you might actually find some guidance.
That would be a great... Okay. That would be great.
Well,
absolutely.
At this point, let's take a quick break. But when we come back, let's talk a bit about how one would start, you know, once you've gotten people to give up their jargon, start actually implementing something like this, and maybe dovetail to a few examples. And we are in the middle of our break between the spring and summer semesters here at Georgia Tech. So I don't know how many folks are out there listening. But if you have a question or comment for Jack about using trees, as a sort of a systematic problem-solving innovation type approach. Maybe you've got an interesting problem that we might want to look at. And you're listening to us live Wednesdays noon to 1. By all means, give us a call here at the studio at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. We'll be right back with Inside the Black Box, science only funnier.
The following is a public service announcement brought to you by the staff of WRK Atlanta. Fernbank Museum seeks volunteers over the age of 18 to assist as greeters, IMAX ushers, exhibit facilitators, pianists, and more. Volunteer benefits at Fernbank include supporting a community cause and making new friends, as well as special discounts, free tickets, and social events. More information is available at 404-929-636 or fernbankmuseum.org.
It's not hard to find the best reggae that Atlanta has to offer. Know your roots. keep it simple. And tune in to 5446, Thursdays from 8 to 9 p.m., only on WREK Atlanta.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where we're talking with Jack Hippel, expert on the systematic problem-solving and innovation algorithm called TREES, about how exactly that works. So before the break, Jack educated me on the fact that in order to sort of make your problem generic, right, you need to get rid of the jargon. And that is certainly a tall order. But once you actually get rid of that, then how does one actually apply the algorithm based on these 40 or so principles that were developed?
Well, the first step in the process, Pete, is to envision what we call in TRIZ, and again, I'm sorry, but we have our own jargon, called the ideal final result. You take the system that you're having a problem with or has a contradiction, and you imagine it not having that. That may sound simple, but I can tell you it's tough for adults to do. If you have a room full of kids, it's not a problem because they can imagine anything. So we start with the definition of an ideal final result without necessarily knowing how we're going to get there. And adults have trouble disconnecting those two things. We then look through the system and look for and identify resources that may not be obvious to people. And you'd be surprised in the real engineering world how often gravity turns out to be the solution to a problem. It's all around us and it's free and people can't see it. Sometimes those two steps alone are enough to solve a problem. If not, we look at the contradictions in a system. I mentioned that when Altshuler put this together, the first thing he did was to put together a contradiction table where he took the engineering parameters of a system on an XY axis and basically said, if you want to improve this parameter and at the same time this other parameter gets worse, here is the inventive principles most often used in the patent literature to solve that problem. And here's where this barrier between the left brain and right brain people comes in, because in that box are four or five inventive principles that 8 million patents tell us solve this problem. So we don't need to generate 1,000 silly ideas and sort through them to get to those four or five. The answers are already there. So that's where part of the disconnect comes.
So to me, that almost seems impossible, because the contradiction, when I try to explain similar principles when we teach design here at Georgia Tech, is, you know, you want to make your car go faster, right? And you think, well, I want to make it go faster, so I want to put in a bigger engine. But a bigger engine is heavier, and the weight makes it go slower. So this weight versus power thing, I mean, is that a simple example of a contradiction?
Absolutely. And if you looked up that particular contradiction in this 60-year-old table, you would find that the solution to that, as expressed back in 1950, was composite materials. And that's exactly how that contradiction is resolved in the auto industry today.
So I use So what you're saying is I'm totally worthless. The example I use in class was thought up back in the 1950s.
It doesn't tell you how to design those composite materials.
Yeah.
It just recognizes that the concept of composites is one of the best ways to resolve the contradiction of weight and speed.
Right. I mean, so when we say composites for our listeners, basically this is a material that combines two or more things to try to get properties that are different than both of them, right? So you want to pick something that's light, and usually light materials are soft and weak. And if you pick something, you know, strong, usually that's heavy. So take metals versus plastics or something, or ceramics versus plastics or something like that. I mean, ceramics are great because they're really strong, but they're brittle, and plastics are really flexible. And now anyone that plays with any reasonably priced tennis racket has a ceramic plastic composite that is unbelievably light and also unbelievably strong. Wow. So that's amazing.
Exactly. And I could show you that, again, on this 60-year-old table. I mentioned the use of resources that people can't see all around them. I believe AirSage, and I believe they're actually headquartered in Atlanta, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
This is a company that is selling a service to emergency preparedness teams in major cities using a resource that people hadn't thought about before. When you are in a traffic slowdown and you don't know what the cause of it is, you might think about what's the first thing you do, and the answer is make a cell phone call.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're in a large city like Atlanta and you're trying to figure out where do I want to position or send the ambulances or the police cars to, sometimes you have to guess. You have to wait for somebody to call.
Right.
But if you aggregate cell phone signals, you know there's a problem, and that information can be basically bundled and sold to Metropolitan Emergency Preparedness to help them prepare for emergencies.
So what you're saying is they had the idea, so they made the observation that if something interesting happens that may not be good, like a traffic accident, something like that,
uh-huh.
The first thing people do is they want to figure out what the heck's going on, so there's suddenly a big burst or a spike of cell phone signals in that area. So when
right,
you
or
see
they call
that,
somebody saying, yeah. I'm going to be late for this meeting
yeah.
or whatever. There's a sudden right. burst of cell phone traffic, and that can be agglomerated, basically, and you instantly know where there's a problem.
Right. Now, is that, so that seems like such a totally reasonable idea. Is that one of the principles of this? I mean, was there a principle from the 40 principles that would could be associated
with
that?
That's the second step in the process. The first one I said was to identify the ideal final result.
Right.
So in this case, we might say the traffic accident identifies itself. And then say, okay, and then you say, using what? Well, the resources we have all around us. Well, what resources do we have? And cell phone, traffic signals is a resource
right.
that we didn't have 30 years ago.
Right.
That is a very common thing today. Sometimes only those first two steps in the algorithm are enough to solve a problem. The third step is this contradiction issue mm-hmm. that I was talking about. And unfortunately, there's a lot of things written on trees where the contradiction table is the only thing that's mentioned in trees and not these first two steps that I mentioned. And I have seen an awful lot of problems solved with just those first two steps.
Right.
And I've shared a couple examples with you. I'm sure your listeners have flown on Boeing 737s.
Yes.
And I would encourage them the next time they get on that airplane to look out the window and look at the engine cowling, the frame around the engine, and observe the fact that it's not round.
Right. It's not. It's very flattened on the bottom type shape, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah. And the mathematical term for that is asymmetric.
Right.
And Boeing, as they were stretching that airplane, were struggling with the fact when they went from the 300 to the 400, the plane's getting longer, there's more baggage, there's more fuel, the engine has to get bigger. But there's an FAA ground clearance requirement because the plane may not land exactly straight, and you can't bump the bottom of the engine against the ground.
Right.
And so Boeing, some very smart Boeing engineers for a long time, struggled with that problem. And then a truth session was run. And they pulled out this 60-year-old contradiction table and said, well, what are we trying to improve? And the answer to that is, I need the area of a moving object to be bigger. Well, what gets worse? Well, it's the length of a moving object. The diameter gets too long. And if you were to look at those two parameters on the table, you would find asymmetry as the suggested solution to that problem. And if you had been in the room, you would have seen a bunch of people saying, I could have had a V8. Smacking themselves in the head.
Uh-huh.
That's where that engine design came from. You may have some listeners also that have parents or may have arthritis problems and have to deal with a wrench. They're not very pleasant. The thinness of the wrench bites into the palm of your hand. And there's a new product on the market called the X-Beam wrench. Came out in about 2006, and it won the Arthritis Foundation of the Year Award. The handle of the wrench is turned 90 degrees so that the flat part, the parallel part, is against the nut that you're trying to tighten.
Oh, yeah.
And the flat part is against the palm of your hand. There's no great new invention here. It doesn't cost any more to make. But you're resolving the contradiction by separating the design of the wrench so that it's narrow in one place and flat in another.
Right, so you're just increasing surface area there.
Where you want it.
Yeah.
Not everywhere, but
right.
Where you want it, which is at the palm of your hand. You have to ask yourself, why couldn't that have been invented 60 years ago?
Yeah, so why couldn't that have been invented 60 years ago?
There is no good reason. If they had had Triz on their brain, they probably would have figured it out.
Well, you make a good point. And my understanding of Triz was always that you start with three. You start with contradiction. So I'm always looking for that contradiction. But it never occurred to me that, you know, simply by visualizing the ideal final result first and then saying, look, there's something that can get me there. But what you're implying is visualizing the ideal result, I mean, that's a little bit of a creative process, right? And you're right, it requires this childlike innocence to say, I want it to magically make this go do that, or I want the traffic jam to identify itself.
Yeah, and again, using what I already have. I want to be cheap. I don't want to spend a bunch of money. I mean, there's lots of complicated ways of solving problems, and engineers love to do that. They love to design things and maintain things, and they all cost a lot of money. And what we want to do in Triz is to find an elegantly simple solution that in hindsight everybody says, why couldn't I have done that 60 years ago?
But if I think about that, having the traffic jam identify itself because of the related activity around it, right? It seems painfully obvious. We have a bunch of folks here, and we've had them on the show in the past, from our Institute for Biologically Inspired Design. And if I think about that, and maybe if I thought sort of, you know, to another field like biology, the way the body identifies all these things where I have to send clotting factors and platelets and inflammatory agents and anti-inflammatory agents is exactly that. It looks for the signal. So whenever something happens, there's a cut, there's trauma, there's a bruise, there's a signal. The signal isn't a cell phone signal, but it's, you know, intracellular chemicals, cytokines, these things that just, there's this big
pillar. Well, and the Triz way of saying that would be information.
Yeah, exactly. So information's passed all over the place. What is that information? Can I detect it and exploit it? And the answer is yes. I mean, it's chemical. You can see that. Electromagnetic radiation, the amount of calls in a cell phone tower. Very, very simple sort of thing to do. Wow. So I didn't quite understand that, just the two first parts. I'm hung up on the third part as well.
Well, remember, step zero is to ask, has someone else already solved this problem? You know, which is using the 10-year-old language to do a web search on.
Right.
I mean, you would be surprised how many times somebody finds an answer to a problem. We did a project with Lockheed Martin on air traffic control displays. Mm-hmm. And the issue is the FAA is trying to increase the amount of information that is displayed on that screen, but the poor person that has to read the screen is trying to deal with more and more information and make quick decisions.
Right.
And I was absolutely amazed to find out that no one in this group of human factors engineers had ever been to a video game convention or read a video game display.
Okay.
Magazine. It's exactly the same problem.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Chemical process control displays. It's all the same problem. And they had never once looked in that area, read a book, been to a meeting, read a magazine, no awareness whatsoever.
So, I mean, when you mention those two things together, the thing I think of, whether you're you're controlling your chemical process, you're an air traffic controller, you have all this information on there, and you need to see it, understand it, interpret it very, very quickly. Rather than having, a dot with all sorts of text associated with it, and I know this from my son's experience playing World of Warcraft and all these weird things online, they'll give it different texture, different color, different shape. And actually, the neat thing now is that they'll make your controller vibrate and move in a different way. So you actually, in addition to looking at what you see at the screen and hearing what you hear from the sound, you know, if somebody hits you with a sword or something like that, I'm thinking of zombies on Call of Duty. You know, if there's a zombie behind you and he whacks you in the head, and if he hits you two more times, you're dead. Your controller will vibrate. So. Uh-huh. As soon as I saw these, some auto manufacturers now, your seat vibrates at you if there's someone coming in your blind spot or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And it's exactly the same thing. And for us old people that aren't used to it, we're like, what? Something vibrating to tell me information? That just seems very unnatural. When I first started playing this game on Xbox, it was very weird for me. But now you're just so used to it that you're like, okay, turn around because somebody's hitting you with an axe and they're a zombie and they're about to kill you. So that, I guess, somehow speaks to the ego thing, to suggest
that
video game folks can tell chemical process or other folks that they could actually learn things about that.
Wow. And maybe vice versa. You know, who knows?
Yeah, yeah. So so you bring up an interesting point. So step zero, right? See if someone's solved it, right? And let's face it, if someone solved it in your field, well, that's pretty easy to see. You'd see the patent literature, you'd see the technical literature. But I guess what you're suggesting is once you've made it general and you realize it's a general problem, has someone solved it but in a different context? Have they solved it in terms of video games or cooking or something like that?
Exactly. And the trick is, I mean, you have to get rid of the ego. You have to believe that someone else may have already solved the problem. And if you can't get to that stage, then you can't make that first step.
So actually what you're talking about, step zero in this systematic method, is really what a lot of people call just general creativity. And they take a lot of credit for it. And the guys I'm thinking of are, maybe Trent or Mitch will know this. Who's the guy that runs Flip Burger here in...
Richard Blaze?
Yeah, so Richard Blaze, he was what? He was one of these stars in one of these cooking shows. And he's all excited about all these new innovative things. And he uses induction cooking. And he makes foams out of cheese. And he puts liquid nitrogen on milkshakes. And I'm like, well, chemists and physicists and engineers have been doing that for years. I mean, foaming in polymer science, where I work, I mean, we've known how to do that for years. He's just stolen it from the chemical process industry and applied it to food. So, yeah, I can think of lots of different examples. So let me get back to something that you said earlier, and that was, you know, when you look for the resources to find this ideal final result, you said sometimes the resources are nice and easy, and they would be things like gravity. So,
well, gravity is not something people recognize
easily.
But, you know, we look for time resources, time during, time before, time after, and people ignore time before, time after quite frequently. Mm-hmm. You know, what can you do with materials on the way to your plant, after they leave your plant? Space, and that means space around, but space within. There's nothing that doesn't have voids in it.
Right.
And one of the classic TRIZ examples is recognition of that in the pepper industry. For, again, one of these 60-year-old stories, people have been popping stems out of peppers to put meat into salad fixings by putting peppers into a small pressure chamber and causing a stress crack and then releasing the pressure, and the stem blows out.
Oh, okay.
And again, I can show you a patent 27 years after that patent where the diamond industry figured out that a much cheaper way of making industrial diamond grinding dust was to put diamonds under 10,000 PSI pressure, and air goes inside the diamond, and you blow it apart into dust. Now, to me, they're exactly the same patent.
Right.
But again, if you're an engineer working for a South African diamond mining company and you go to your boss and say, I'd like to go to an ag equipment show to get some ideas, would you still have a job after you asked a question?
Probably not. So let me see if I can understand this, right? So you take something, you know, very typical in one field and realize that really is general, right? That this, for example, composite materials you talked about before, composite materials can exist in any field, and so can creating a void space in something that will change its properties such that its mechanical and fracture conditions are different.
That's right.
And we do that all the time with, say, processing of synthetic polymers and things like that. So I think of foams, right? If you want to insulate something, we foam a lot of materials, whether they're ceramic or whether they're polymeric. And by putting that extra space in there, that can very often be a very good thing, right? So if you want to fill something with space, something that will insulate against, you know, thermal conductivity, putting air in it is a really, really good thing. And then if you think about it, say I'm dealing with cheese, and let's take the blue cheese family, right? Very, very strong. Nobody likes to take a bite like an apple out of a chunk of blue cheese or gorgonzola or something like that. But you like the subtle taste. So what if you foamed it? What if you filled it with air so that you got this finite amount of stuff, but it was more subtle because it was mixed with air? I mean, if you think about it, the wine people like your red wine to mix with air, right? You wouldn't want to carbonate it, but could you aerate wine? Stuff like that. And we aerate things all the time in the processing of, you know, sewage waste, right? Because that gets oxygen to the microbes and things like that. Man, you got me thinking of a million different things now. So even
well, the voids can be useful by themselves, or they could, in principle, incorporate something that could be released later.
Right, right.
I'm sure many of your listeners have relatives or parents that have diabetes,
mm-hmm.
and it's an insidious disease. But I find very few people that know why you have to take insulin as a shot. I mean, every other medicine right. we take, we pop a pill and glass of water, and that's the end of it. Why do we have to take insulin as a shot? Well, the reason is because insulin is destroyed by the gastric acid in your stomach.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to bypass the stomach and get into the intestinal tract directly, or else it doesn't work. And there's a company in stage 3 clinicals right now that is resolving that contradiction by taking insulin and encapsulating it in a material, and I don't know the details of it, with a material that swells in the presence of gastric acid.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So it passes through the stomach and protects it until it gets into the intestinal tract. And that illustrates the ideal result. I want the insulin to go through the system and not be attacked by the stomach. It also illustrates the use of resources. We would ordinarily think of gastric acid in the stomach as a negative thing, but we use the negative resource in a positive way.
Right.
And
right.
that again, is when we look at resources in trees, we don't just list the things that are good. We list the things that are bad and say, how could we use them in a positive way?
Right. Okay. All right, so let's take a quick break, and when we come back, let's finish up with a few examples and see if we can summarize this whole thing. But once again, if any of our listeners are listening live Wednesdays noon to 1, and you've got a question or comment about using TRIZ to generally attack problems and innovation, give us a call here at the studio at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. We'll be right back with Inside the Black Box, science only funnier.
Turn on, tune in, and drop out while listening to Atmospherics every Monday through Thursday from midnight to 1:30 a.m. on WRAK Atlanta, 91.1 FM.
Bizarre, inviting you to tune into my country music classics here on WREK at 91.1 Friday evenings at 5 o'clock. We come alive at 5 with great old-time music. String bands, bluegrass, old country blues, a little of everything, jug bands, anything that you can imagine, you'll hear on the country music classics. All happy music. A little jug band. Don't forget, this is Friday at 5. We come alive right here with the Country Music Classics on WREK-FM 91.1. Make it a habit. Tune in. Love to have you. That's Fridays at 5 right here on WREK 91.1.
All right, welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where we're talking with Jack Hipple about the systematic approach to problem solving called TRIZ. And basically, what we talked about in the last segment is that this whole, once you get past your ego and realize the solution might exist in another field, that's actually a pretty easy thing to figure out nowadays just by Googling it, right? Provided you get rid of the jargon, right? Is that the approach?
Right.
And I think basically last segment you showed us an example that basically said TRIZ in its, you know, purest approach is responsible for all of controlled drug delivery, basically. Because I'm familiar with what Bob Langer at MIT does in that field and basically saying, look, you have this polymer, it'll eventually degrade. Can we put something in the space? And ironically, Bob gives a talk about this, and I have a couple of his slides because I use it in my educational lectures, that people said, oh, you'll never get it in the space. It'll never come out of the space. It's not a good thing to put it in the space. They basically gave him 10 reasons why this would never work to fill spaces in polymers with a drug to do controlled drug release. He does it, you know, under the skin, the pericardium, in the stomach, these sorts of things as well. So there is a formidable array of ideas against this sort of thing. But during the break, we were talking about something you mentioned at the very beginning of the program, and that is this evolution concept to TRIZ. What's that all about?
Well, when people continue to study the patent literature, they not only identified repeated use of the same inventive principles, but also identify what we call lines of evolution that are predictive in the sense that they forecast the general direction of product and technology evolution.
Mm-hmm.
They are not time forecasting lines. They don't say when, but they're qualitative.
Right.
And one of them is a field evolution line. If you think about how we used to communicate, we banged on drums, and then we sent smoke signals up, and then we wrote letters, and then we had phone lines, and now we have wireless. That's an example of one of these lines. We go from mechanical to thermal to chemical to electronic to electromagnetic. You've seen the same thing in a lot of chemical processes. I'm not sure we ever beat styrene monomer, but we certainly used to heat it up and just hope that we got the right molecular weight.
Right,
and then we
right.
went into some very sophisticated chemical catalyst systems. And you see people now playing around with microwave catalysis. Not economical yet,
mm-hmm.
but microwave ovens used to cost $500 too.
Right.
So this is a predictive thing, and many of these fields are discontinuous. So somebody with chemical background will not be reading the electronics literature. So we have the same disconnect that people have to get rid of the framework that they normally think in and look at the next field that might be
right.
coming along.
Right.
The other line that applies very universally is what we call dynamism. Systems get more dynamic and responsive over time. And of course, anybody that flies an airplane today has seen that in spades in airline pricing. I saw an interview with the CEO of American Airlines one time who said they changed airline pricing 30,000 times a day. I'm still trying to digest that, the computer power that must be required to do that. You've seen the Yorgage ads on TV.
Right, the Your Mortgage, right.
Yeah. Well, you know, what has ever kept us from mortgage being 8 years instead of 10 or mm-hmm. 20 or 30? Why can't it be 6 years, 3 months, and 2 days? I mean, we're getting there. And Triz would say that this Yorgage would have happened, and somebody could have taken advantage of that long before that particular mortgage company did.
So you actually make a really interesting point, right? So for those of us that work in chemical and mechanical engineering, there's a whole group of folks called the systems people. And the systems people used to do control of chemical plants and mechanical manufacturing, right? So these are the guys, when your reactor is getting too hot, they change the influx of the reactants to make it go back to its steady state so that the product that comes out, like you mentioned polystyrene before, is uniform. It's always the same molecular weight and has the same properties. But what those guys are doing is they've solved a lot of those problems. So I know what my colleagues in that field do is they now say, why aren't we applying this to all these other weird sorts of things? And whether it's, you know, online pricing for airlines or online auctions for, what was I looking at the other day, a website, a domain, right? So
uh-huh.
there's dynamic auctions that will, you know, they'll dynamically change depending on demand, whether you want this website or this sort of thing. And now they're looking for new places to apply it. So in a sense, what they're doing is they're exploiting this evolution trend of this dynamism. Is that what you call it?
Yeah. And what you're describing is the reverse of the stage zero we talked about at the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
I know how to do this in my industry. Where else could it apply?
Oh, okay. So that's actually the reverse of
stage zero. So that's one way of looking at this. I'm sure your listeners have, what's her face that does the auto insurance commercials?
Flo, is that who you're talking about?
Flo on Progressive is who I'm thinking about.
Yeah.
If you're willing to put a sensor in your car, linked to a satellite, your car insurance rate will vary with your driving behavior.
Oh yeah.
In other words, why in the world should you pay collision insurance when your car is sitting in the garage? Does that make any sense at all?
Or if you're a safe driver who never drives over the speed limit. That's why I don't have that sensor in my car, because I drive
right.
in Atlanta.
Okay. I know there's a privacy issue here, but it illustrates dynamism. It also illustrates the use of resources. We didn't have satellites that could keep track of things that way. But auto insurance is now dynamic, if you're willing to trade that informational resource.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about, so how would one learn trees, right? So you do workshops on this, right?
Yeah. The engineering societies have three-day workshops that I teach. I'm obviously not the only one that does that. Mm-hmm. You could type TRIZ into a browser and find other folks. So it is taught by engineering societies. There's a nonprofit Altshuler Institute in the U.S., AITRIZ.org. Mm-hmm. That's the Institute of People Who Practice Trees in the U.S. There is a similar association in Europe called the European Trees Association, ETRIA.net. There also is a Mexican Trees Association. I don't have that web link off the top of my head, but it could be found, and they have a meeting once a year, as do the other organizations. I know the European meeting is in Paris around the 1st of November this year.
And actually, for those of you interested in exactly what Jack does, there is a link on our website to Jack and what he does with his company, in case you're interested in that. And that, of course, is at www.insidetheblackbox.org if they're interested in additional information. But so how long were these
workshops? I was going to say there also are probably 50 or 60 books out on trees,
So
including the one I wrote last year.
It seems... so painfully obvious that this should work. Why isn't everybody using this?
Two reasons, and the same answers that I give to everybody. The ego issue that I mentioned before, it is very difficult for people to admit that maybe their problem is not special and not unique. That's one of the reasons it's been very slow to catch on in academia.
Okay. No, and clearly...
And the second thing, this is a very left-brain algorithmic process that has a methodology to it.
Right.
It's not as much fun as some of the other techniques. And so people sometimes do not want to spend the time up front defining the problem. They want to jump into the solution space, and solving the wrong problem 10 times is a lot more fun than solving the right problem once. Those are the two barriers.
But, I mean, as engineers and scientists, don't we like this left-brain systematic thing? I mean...
Yes, and that's, you know, its application in the engineering world has been its primary use around the world.
Okay.
But engineers, yes, if they can get rid of their egos.
So you basically have a similar problem with some of my colleagues here at the Georgia Tech Library, right? So say I'm tackling a new problem. The very first thing I do is, even though it's not in this systematic way, is to see, has someone solved it similarly? And I realize I do actually go through the internet and try to make things generic. So I think I've done step zero in my own way without realizing it to see if someone had come up with a solution to this or that. And when you go to a librarian assumes that all interesting solutions have already been formulated. You just have to find them. Whereas as engineers and scientists, we think anything that's cool, no one's done. So we might as well invent it 10 different times and enjoy doing it. And the truth is obviously somewhere in between. So people don't like librarians because they're like, well, let's see if we can find something similar that shows you what that solution might be. So,
and all TRIZ does is provide the framework and the algorithm for doing that.
Right. And framework and algorithm for systematically addressing these conflicts and the resources to to figure out your ideal result. It just doesn't sound sexy, as opposed to doing improv in the corporate boardroom and drawing cartoons on the whiteboards on the wall.
You are absolutely correct. It's probably more fun to learn trees from me than some of the Russian immigrants, but it's tough to make it is hard to make trees as much fun as brainstorming or CPS or De Bono or any of the things that you're talking about.
Right, and so I am one of those type folks. I am a De Bono lateral thinking improv guy, but I don't actually see a contradiction between these things, and I think actually... when I look at trees, I think it's very useful, and I think now I have a better understanding of how we can apply our sort of little creative bursts inside this framework to make it work even better. I like the framework. In fact, I was talking with my colleague Lou Lefton, who works on this with me, and we're talking about characterizing humor, And we realized that we're trying to write characteristics of humor in terms of a vector, you know, so that we can look at the magnitude of that vector and the dot product that vector with something else and things like that. And, you know, describing a joke by a vector, Trent, who's at the board here, is a discrete mathematician. You're not getting excited about describing jokes by a vector?
That sounds awful.
I was excited about that, which really tells you how bizarre I am. But we have reached that portion of the program we like to call What Have We Learned? And what we've learned is that the number one step to applying TRIZ, the systematic problem-solving method for innovation, is to get rid of the ego. And realize that your problem, like a librarian would say, is not unique, that it may bear resemblance to many, many other problems. So once you generalize it, you can execute step zero in TRIZ, which is just now Google, right? That was a lot harder before. Uh-huh. And see if someone has found that solution in another field. And what you're telling me is culturally, we need to stop penalizing weird people that work in one field that want to go to a conference in another field where they might learn something. Right, so I'm going to remember that. That's very important. Then the next thing is to do something that's very childlike. Visualize the ideal results. My colleague Steve Harvey in biology, we do a lot of simulations, right, and all these equations running and molecules moving about. And he always forces the student to ask this question, what if everything works perfectly? What would the ideal result of this thing be?
Exactly, and you need to use the word itself. When somebody comes back. If you're not using that word, you haven't been aggressive enough with the thought process.
Right, right. And students have a hard time answering that question. And what you're pointing out is sometimes just visualizing that can allow you to realize that, you know, once you do the second step, look for resources that can help you deal with that. Sometimes the resources are obvious. And that great example you gave of information in the form of a concentration of cell phone calls near something like a traffic accident is a great idea. And it really costs you nothing. It's just grabbing the information, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then finally, the final step that you do is if you see one of these contradictions, right, about weight versus power, right, which is the classic one I use. And the example I give them in class is composite materials. And that's because we're familiar with composite materials. But what you're telling me is this table of contradictions proposed the idea of composite materials back in the 50s. I find that absolutely amazing. So,
that's not the only solution to the weight versus power contradiction, but that's the.
So there's other ones in this table of contradictions.
Right.
And is something like a 3-day workshop enough for me to become sufficiently fluent on this to start using it?
Enough to get well started. Yes.
Okay. All right. I'm already excited about the whole thing. And the interesting thing is it comes from 40 principles that were observed in the patent literature by Altshuler?
Heinrich Altshuler.
Back in the late 40s. Wow. So TRIZ, give it a try. That's my conclusion there. Is there anything we left out about that?
I guess the next public workshop is in Orlando, May 20 to 22.
Right, and like I said, they can find out about that on your website by going to insidetheblackbox.org.
Okay.
So, Jack, thanks so much for being on the program.
My pleasure. It's been fun.
Right. And if any of our listeners have a question or comment about this program or a suggestion for a future show, by all means, send us an email at comments@insidetheblackbox.org. And even though you didn't hear it today, our theme music is composed and performed by Bill and Mary Hunt. Our chief engineer is Trent Altman, and we are a production of the WREK Studios here on the campus of the Georgia Institute of Technology. Please join us next week for Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier.